Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Monday, the 17th of April. Fighting has continued into the night in Sudan as rival military factions battle for control of the capital. Nearly 60 civilians have been killed. Islamic State fighters have attacked a group foraging for truffles in the Syrian desert, reportedly leaving 36 people dead. And dissident guerrillas in Colombia say they are ready to start formal peace talks with the government. Also in the podcast, President Biden condemns a mass shooting in the US at a 16th birthday party in Alabama. And the troll hunters battling climate change deniers.
After a couple of months, you realize you don't make an impact because for most of these people, facts are irrelevant.
The latest reports from Sudan suggest fighting is continuing between rival wings of the military despite an earlier agreement for a temporary ceasefire. As night fell, the regular armed forces carried out airstrikes on bases belonging to the Rapid Support Forces militia in Omdurman, Khartoum's twin city, while fires could be seen in the capital itself. Nearly 60 civilians are reported to have been killed in 2 days of fighting, including three UN staff, as well as an unknown number of soldiers. The violence erupted early on Saturday, the culmination of a long-running power struggle between Sudan's military ruler, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and his deputy, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, better known as Hemeti, who controls the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Khalid Hare from the think tank Confluence Advisory lives in Khartoum.
We went to sleep, a very disturbed sleep where we could get it, and woke up to a soundtrack of various levels of gunfire, light weaponry, AK-47s, all the way up to DSKs or Doshkas and heavy artillery. And that's been a sort of constant soundtrack over the past 48 hours. All civilians have been urged to stay at home. That has not kept everyone safe. There are a lot of people who either being in their homes or being sort of in and around their homes and rooftops in the gardens, etc., that have been either hurt or killed by a stray bullet. Last night, the Sudan Armed Forces released a statement saying that it will be doing a sweep of neighborhoods for RSF troops. And of course, because RSF troops have embedded themselves in densely populated neighborhoods, will of course have an element of indiscriminate killing to them. So the cost of this has already skyrocketed.
It's difficult to gauge who would have the upper hand. This is a conflict that is being fought in the streets, but also online on social media by both Rapid Support Forces, a paramilitary group, and the Sudan Armed Forces, the official army. By both the leaders of those two entities, they have both been on Arabic language satellite channels in the past 24 hours using increasingly bellicose language that tells us that they are not likely to back down voluntarily. And it sort of shows us how they're using those platforms in order to make pleas to the Sudanese public, effectively saying that they are doing this because they're trying to protect democracy. I think what they both misunderstand is that predominantly the Sudanese public wants neither of them.
Khalid Khair in Khartoum. Well, shortly after the three-hour humanitarian truce was due to end, I spoke to the BBC's Beverly Ochieng, who is monitoring events from Nairobi.
It's not clear the ceasefire was well communicated, given the breakdown of media services and reports of heavy fighting, not just in Khartoum, but in other parts of Sudan. And the warring parties have continued to issue conflicting or even competing statements about their action on the ground, about some battleground gains that they have been getting. And from what we're hearing, RSF forces are embedding themselves among civilians, many of whom were caught off guard by this fighting. The ceasefire, of course, comes after appeals by doctors and emergency workers to be able to safely evacuate those who have been wounded. There are tallies of about 70 people who have been killed, and a doctors' union is calling for urgent aid to help those who are in need. But with flights being cancelled in Khartoum, it's going to be very difficult for external aid to reach many in Sudan who have been devastated by the violence.
Yeah, most of the footage we've seen has been from the capital, including military jets in the sky. What's going on in the rest of Sudan?
Well, one critical area where there had been initial confrontations between the army and the RSF was in the northern town of Meroe, which has an airbase. And the RSF attempted to seize this, and there was clashes. In Khartoum, the twin city of Omdurman, the premises of the state broadcaster was attacked yesterday, and as of today, it's off air. And in Darfur, yesterday when the clashes began, there were reports of about 6 people and a soldier having been killed. And then the other thing is that the forces are claiming to seize areas or command centers that are dispersed across Sudan, and many of them are within residential areas, so the risk to civilians is becoming increasingly high.
I'm just seeing reports that the regional African bloc is sending the presidents of Kenya, South Sudan and Djibouti to Sudan. Can they make any difference?
Well, to begin with, Sudan has been kicked out of the African Union, and it's been heavily censured by regional and international bodies because of the coup. It's not clear if they will make any headway. There's been lack of political consensus. A deal has essentially collapsed, but we will see if a mediation process is going to be possible, given the stern statements from the general who are warring at the moment.
Beverly Ocheng in Nairobi with the latest on the situation in Sudan. Well, the outbreak of fighting has raised huge doubts over a hoped-for transition to civilian rule following a coup 18 months ago. The US, China, Russia and Saudi Arabia have all called for an end to the violence. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner explains why this crisis is causing international concern.
Sudan is one of the poorest countries per capita in the Arab world, but its natural resources and its strategic location on the Red Sea have attracted the attention of its Arab neighbours as well as global powers like the US. Russia is keen to establish a naval base on the Red Sea coast and has been in talks about this with Sudan's military leaders. Washington wants to prevent this and also has no wish to see Sudan return to the days when it hosted terrorist groups like Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda. Under US pressure, Sudan recently established diplomatic relations with Israel. Nearer at hand, Egypt is in a close alliance with Khartoum, with both countries viewing Ethiopia with suspicion bordering on hostility. Since the ousting of Sudan's military ruler, General Omar al-Bashir, in 2019, both Saudi Arabia and the UAE have built up ties with Khartoum. The Saudis persuaded Sudan to send forces to join its side in Yemen's disastrous civil war. The UAE sees Sudan as part of a regional network against political Islam, which it views as a threat to its way of government, none of which holds out much hope of an early end to Sudan's internal struggles.
Our security correspondent Frank Gardner. In the US, there have been more mass shootings than days this year, at least 140, including 9 reported on Saturday, according to the Gun Violence Archive. In the deadliest attack on Saturday evening, 4 people were shot dead and 28 wounded at a 16th birthday party in Dadeville, Alabama. Despite the rise in these types of killings, many Americans and their political leaders support gun ownership, not least the governor of Alabama, Kay Ivey, who was pictured at a shooting range in her 2018 re-election campaign.
President Trump said Kay Ivey is a great governor.
Woman knows how to get a bang for her buck. Straight shooter, that KIV.
Yeah, put your aim to shame.
Yeah, look who's talking.
This weekend, Donald Trump and other frontrunners for the Republican presidential nomination defended gun rights at the annual National Rifle Association convention. But President Joe Biden issued a statement on Sunday condemning the killings in Alabama and said most Americans want stricter gun control legislation. For more on the Alabama shooting, I spoke to Nomia Iqbal in Washington.
Just to let you know a little bit about Dadeville, it's a very small rural town. It's in the east of Alabama. It probably takes about 2 hours to get there from here in DC. A very small population of about 3,200 people. What we are learning so far from local media, so I do need to emphasise it's not been confirmed yet by officials, that one of the victims is thought to be a senior in high school, a potential future football star. He's been named as Phil Dowdle. He was on his way to Jacksonville State University on an American football scholarship, and he was at this party, which was, according to, again, local media reports, to celebrate the 16th birthday of his sister. Now, again, just to let you know, local media, this is the Montgomery Advertiser, it's reporting that the young man who was shot dead, his mother was also shot and wounded.
And given that the governor of Alabama used gun ownership in her re-election campaign, it suggests that it is popular in the state. And of course, in America, you're seeing these Republican leaders flock to the NRA convention.
Yes, if anything, they really do stick with the NRA in a way that perhaps I certainly haven't seen previously. And, you know, it's almost hard to keep up with the carnage. It was only 2 weeks ago that I was in Nashville covering this mass shooting at a private Christian school, and it's a familiar cycle. And for those who want tighter gun control, you know, you've played that video there. It's not going to happen, especially in Alabama.
Nomia Iqbal in Washington. Climate ministers from the G7 group of industrialized nations meeting in Japan have agreed to speed up efforts to phase out fossil fuels. Despite such attempts to deal with the issue, activists are concerned about the rise of conspiracy theories on social media, saying that climate change is all a hoax. But those spreading misleading narratives are now being targeted by internet vigilantes, as the BBC's Marco Silva found out.
I've come to a town on the Spanish coast to meet Maria, one of the founders of Team Ninja Troll Hunters. I'm not telling you her real name or where exactly we're meeting. She's afraid doing so would put her at risk.
For you to be able to do your work, to be effective and not be scared of the consequences, you really have to fly under the radar.
Today the group has about 25 members scattered around the world. Their work began in 2019.
When we started, we were five. And one thing I personally did was to debunk all these false claims.
Anything that contradicted the basic facts of climate change, like this.
The Earth is not getting warmer. It is coming out from a cold period. Hashtag climate scam.
But after a couple of months, you realize you don't make an impact because for most of these people, facts are irrelevant.
So Maria and the ninjas embraced new tactics.
Climate change denial was never an issue for Twitter.
As in, it was never forbidden.
But I realized that was some obvious overlap between climate change denial and some other things that were indeed reportable.
Things like hate speech, abuse, or misleading information that harms people. The sort of content anyone can report to Twitter, and that might get an account suspended. So the ninjas used this to their advantage. They thought, Twitter might be okay with people spreading climate denial, but if they tweet something else that breaks the rules, we'll be on to them.
At the end of the day, it doesn't matter whether they get suspended because of COVID-19 misinformation or some Nazi symbols. When they're gone, they're gone.
Someone might look at your group and perhaps fairly describe you as the thought police.
Yes. And when you open your account, you know the rules, you agree.
The ninjas claim to have got 600 Twitter accounts suspended. One of them was Mike Jaggers. He's an Australian engineer with more than 20,000 followers on Twitter. In his bio, he describes himself as a climate realist.
Someone who doesn't perhaps take hook, line and sinker the message and the agenda of climate alarmism.
Scientists have proven beyond reasonable doubt human activity is driving climate change. But Mike is not convinced. And on Twitter, he's found a willing audience among those who believe in conspiracy theories, not just about global warming, but also about COVID-19. Last year, Mike's account was suspended over a tweet suggesting COVID vaccines were triggering a medical condition that does not exist. In November last year, less than a month after billionaire Elon Musk took over Twitter, thousands of previously suspended accounts were reinstated, including Mike's.
That was a slap in the face. If Twitter decided that these people should be suspended, there was a reason for it.
Twitter didn't respond to any of my requests for comment. But Elon Musk's takeover of the company has made the ninjas rethink their future, as previously suspended accounts return to the platform. Maria has left Twitter, but other members of the group have stayed put.
We started something that even if we are not there anymore, is still rolling and is still working, and I wish more people would do it.
Maria, ending that report by Marco Silva. And if you'd like to find out more about this story, search for BBC Trending wherever you get your podcasts. And still to come on this podcast. The curtains come down for the final time on Broadway's longest running show. Amid the economic devastation from a decade of war in Syria, some people try to make ends meet by foraging for truffles. The seasonal delicacies can fetch a high price, but the remote desert region where they grow is also home to Islamic State fighters. And on Sunday, IS militants attacked a group searching for truffles in the northwest of Syria, killing 36 people, including 17 government guards, according to a monitoring group. I heard more from our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
We don't have a huge amount of details, actually, on this specific attack. But I mean, it seems to follow the pattern of what we've seen before, in that one of these isolated areas, gunmen have suddenly appeared and have opened fire on them. I mean, we saw back in February a really appalling incident when 68 people were killed. That's civilians and military who are also with them in an attack by gunmen who suddenly appeared on motorbikes from the desert. I mean, you can imagine these are remote areas. The desert covers a huge amount of Syria, and there's a particular part of it not that far from Hama where it's known for the quality of the truffles, and so that's why it draws people despite these risks.
And tell us more about how they go about finding these truffles.
Well, there's a season, it's from February to April. And there are areas, obviously, which are known fertile places for them to go to. There is sometimes a military guard with them. The other hazard they're facing is landmines. These are areas, really wild lands, but also areas where there was a lot of fighting with ISIS because of its remoteness. It was an area which was constantly changing hands between government forces and between ISIS for the long period that ISIS was at its most dominant in the region. And ISIS, again, because of remoteness, has managed to maintain those hideouts in the these areas, which are pretty much lawless. So when people go out there, although these are people who one assumes do this regularly, so they know to some extent the dangers where the landmines are, what they can't be 100% sure of is whether that area is one where ISIS or groups linked to ISIS will suddenly appear and attack them.
But for them, it seems that they're willing to take the risk.
Yeah, because of what you can earn from a day's truffle hunting, a kilogram on the market, and this is just locally in Syria, will earn considerably more than an average monthly wage. So that's well worth it for Syrians who are impoverished. I mean, these truffles, as you can imagine, do go beyond Syria as well. There are markets in the Gulf, there are markets in Iraq, there are markets in Jordan. So because of that, there's a criminality built into this. I mean, there are other groups which will descend on the truffle hunters once they've got their haul of truffles and will basically offer them a price which they can't refuse, which will not be the price they'll get in the market. So there is hazard all along this process, but one which, looking at what people have said after these attacks, it is like gambling, but it's a gamble that they're willing to take.
Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher. The Iranian authorities have closed down more than 150 shops and restaurants over the past 24 hours for failing to comply with strict rules on women wearing headscarves in public. Last week, police in Iran announced a plan to enforce the wearing of hijabs using surveillance and facial recognition technology. Iran's strict dress code has been at the centre of the protest movement that arose from the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in police custody. Parham Gobardi of the BBC Persian service told me more about the latest crackdown.
So Iran's police chief vowed to prosecute any woman in Iran who defies the Islamic dress code, starting from Saturday. However, that did not stop women from going about their business without wearing the hijab. And on a daily basis, many women in Iran post videos and pictures of themselves without the compulsory hijab on the streets of, and not only capital Tehran, across the country. This was a totally spontaneous move that happened after months of protests in Iran that was called Woman Life Free. Now, Iranian regime has adopted different tactics instead of confronting Iranian women directly. So nowadays, they issue warnings to business owners. Today only, they issued 3,500 warnings to different businesses across the country, and they shut down 150 of them. Another tactic they're using is using CCTV cameras, speed cameras, to detect any car or taxis that is carrying women without hijab, fining them or seizing the cars. Also, refusing entry and service to women who do not abide by the compulsory hijab. For example, we received a video at BBC Persian today that showed many Iranian female students who were barred from entering the campus because, quote unquote, they were wearing makeup or did not have appropriate hijab.
Now, we've seen the Chinese Communist Party effectively control the population through surveillance. Will this tactic in Iran
allow the authorities to stamp out dissent.
That is the dream. However, I'm not sure about the facial recognition at this point. What they're doing mainly is from the license plate numbers, try to register, find out who is not wearing hijab, and then find the car owner, actually. So the reason they're doing this is to put pressure on businesses and people to confront women instead of the police confronting Iranian women directly and violently.
And so could this spell the end of the protest movement?
I don't think so, because it's not like it used to be, but still it is going on. Daily defiance of women is the continuation of that protest. And, you know, Iranian women are being targeted on different fronts. At the same time, Iranian schoolgirls are being poisoned across the country. One father today who was filming his poisoned daughter on a hospital bed asked Iranian officials that you have installed CCTV camera to detect women without hijab. Why don't you use them to find the perpetrators? A legitimate question that Iranian authorities haven't answered yet.
Parham Gobadi of the BBC Persian Service. Dissident Marxist guerrillas in Colombia say they are ready to start peace talks with the government 1 month from now. They split from the main FARC rebel group when it agreed a landmark peace deal back in 2016. Sasha Schlichter has the details.
When the FARC, Latin America's most fearsome guerrilla group, signed a peace agreement 7 years ago, ending 5 decades of bloody conflict, one faction chose to continue the fight. But Colombia's first ever leftist president, Gustavo Petro, has pursued negotiations with the FARC dissidents locked in a bloody war over drugs and mining resources. The result has been a 6-month ceasefire. On Sunday, they announced they were ready to start formal peace talks on the 16th of May. They're estimated to have some 3,000 fighters operating mostly in the Amazon, on the Pacific coast, and near the border with Venezuela.
Sasha Schlichter. The trial begins on Monday of one of the world's most powerful media organisations, US TV network Fox News, which is being sued for $1.6 billion for defamation by a voting machine company. Dominion Systems alleges that Fox News ruined its reputation by airing false claims from Donald Trump and his lawyers that the company's machines were used to rig the outcome of the 2020 presidential election in favour of his Democratic Party rival, Joe Biden. Ronald Anderson Jones, a law professor at the University of Utah, spoke to Gary O'Donoghue about the wider implications of what's being described as a blockbuster trial.
This case is a massive one, not just because it potentially involves $1.6 billion in damages, but also because it sits at the intersection of some of our most important social and legal and constitutional and political values. It's a case that is forcing us to think about our climate for disinformation. One of the things that is most interesting to those of us who are following it closely is that it really is teeing up this narrative battle between the two parties about core values of American democracy. It's always the case that media defendants are arguing democracy values, saying that it's important to preserve press freedom in a democracy. But this is the rare defamation case where the plaintiffs, the voting machine company, are also arguing that American democracy is on the line in a way that favors them.
So what does Dominion have to prove? Because free speech, First Amendment rights, is what Fox is arguing, right?
That's right. Defamation law in the United States heavily favors media defendants, and it favors them in large part out of a fear that defamation suits might be weaponized to shut down conversations on matters of public concern. So the Supreme Court has said it actually has to clear a very high constitutional barrier before it can win against an entity like Fox. The rule here is that it isn't enough to show that there was a lie, and it isn't enough to show that that lie damaged the voting machine company's reputation. Dominion has to go in and show that that lie was told with knowing falsity or with reckless disregard for the truth. It's a state of mind piece of evidence. They have to show essentially that Fox made a conscious corporate decision to tell this falsehood. It's not enough that it was sloppy or negligent or even that it was biased or inaccurate. It has to show something close to a known lie.
Now, Rupert Murdoch has not done his business, Fox News, any good already by some of the things he's already said about what his anchors and reporters were saying during that period.
Rupert Murdoch is shaping up to be a really central witness in all of this. There's some expectation that he may take the stand in the case as early as next week, and all eyes in America are on that. In earlier depositions in the case, he made a few statements that suggested that he might have a heavier role in the decision-making at the news level at Fox News, and that might be key. One of the things that Dominion has to do here is connect the dots between the decision to make the actual statements about that voting machine company and some of the knowing falsity that Dominion says exists at higher rungs of the corporate structure. So his testimony may be key in their ability to link that up. All eyes in America are on this case. There is a major ongoing conversation throughout America about the tensions that exist in our media and our political environments, and particularly a focus on questions of disinformation. As we look ahead to the possibility of these same complexities arising in our next 2024 presidential election. So I think there is incredible attention focused on the case, and there will be for the next several weeks.
Law Professor Ronald Anderson Jones. On Sunday, the curtains came down for the final time on the longest-running show on Broadway. The Phantom of the Opera by Andrew Lloyd Webber has been a fixture on the New York theatre scene since 1988, but recent financial wobbles have brought an end to the much-loved musical. Madeline Drury reports.
That chilling organ has been rocking New York's Majestic Theatre since 1988. 13,733 performances later, The Phantom of the Opera will bid its final farewell to an audience of famous faces and fans. Actor Ted Keegan has been working on the production for over 20 years.
To be looking at this as being our final week open, you know, we've known for months at this point. It was always looming far in the future. It didn't seem as though it was something that was imminent.
The composer and godfather of modern musicals, Andrew Lloyd Webber, has said the show cost up to $1 million a week to stage. And with ticket sales in decline since the COVID-19 lockdown, the production has failed to recoup those costs, reportedly losing $1 million each month. Concertmaster Joyce Hammond leads Broadway's largest pit of 27 full-time musicians on the show, 11 of whom have huddled under the stage playing those beloved bars since its opening. Hammond has 33 years of Phantom under her belt herself.
This is what's really amazing. The world has changed. We have not changed. You know, we've been through awful things, the 9/11, Hurricane Sandy, the pandemic, and we come back and it's just more grateful every time to have it to come back to.
Nearly 20 million people have watched Lloyd Webber's Gothic Romance on Broadway, and the production team say it has employed around 6,500 people over the years. Richard Poole, the show's longest-running cast member, totting up 35 years, is among them.
I get up every morning and I still pinch myself, even to this day. When we see that there's a closing, I still pinch myself and go, I can't believe I've had this experience. It's amazing.
Immediately after the show's closing was announced in February last year, Phantom enjoyed its highest grossing week ever, to the tune of $2.2 million. This secured an 8-week extension to its final curtain call. Being awarded New York's Key to the City, a recognition from the mayor for service to the public this week, Andrew Lloyd Webber spoke of his love for the place.
Broadway has always been my kind of dream, and Broadway is the reason that so many people come to New York, and I felt very, very much a part of the community. Even though I'm British, I still feel that this is the home of musicals and where I want to be.
It may no longer have its name in lights on Broadway, but...
The Phantom of the Opera is there.
A report by Madeline Drury. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News Podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Danny Cox and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.